from the beginning.
And I was shown that that Lucifer would return, that the UN and the Vatican were going to be completely behind it, again, under false pretenses. He's going to show up and say, I'm here to save the day, right? And okay, fine, you know.
Yeah, of course, you can say whatever you want. But I've always hated censorship. It's the internet.
Sometimes, you know, once they get you for your first love bite, well, it depends on how aware you are, right?
First of all, as you know, the Anunnaki and the Draco are enemies. Second of all, underneath Baghdad was a stargate that was created by the Anunnaki so that they could transfer from the Uluru to the Earth.
I'll never see the sun. I could just end it all, but the demons will have won.
Actual practitioners that, you know, some are good and some use their magic for good and to heal and to help, and others do use it for evil. And, you know, in some cases, you know, people really were
This is too much sometimes.
From the broken ruins of Babylon, this is End of Days Radio. The date is September 3rd, 2017. This is Daniel. I am your host, broadcasting all the way from the shimmering Emerald City, right here in the heart of the Pacific Northwest. Here we are once again, sailing the black ship into the abyss. My guest today is Dr. Matthew Alford. He's a scholar whose thesis applied Ed Herman and Noam Chomsky's propaganda model to the contemporary Hollywood film industry. He is now the author of many articles and books on Hollywood propaganda, including his latest book, National Security Cinema, The Shocking New Evidence of Government Control in Hollywood. And be sure to stay tuned after the break. We've got quite a few things to talk about, including the hurricane, North Korea, an update on my reptilian challenge, and some letters from fans. But right now I'm going to go ahead and dial up our guest. Hello.
Daniel. Hey, how you doing?
Hi, Matthew. Welcome to the End of Days.
Oh, thanks very much.
How are you doing today?
I'm okay, thanks. Needed a bit of extra time to get home, but I'm back now. And looking forward to the show.
Okay, excellent. Well, what I like to do to start things off is just ask, how have things been going for you? Is there anything new happening in your world lately?
Well, I've got the new book out, National Security Cinema, which has only been out for, 6 weeks or so, maybe 8 weeks. So we're still, you know, still quite a few things happening with that, although this will probably be my last interview for a while. I'm about to start teaching again, loads of teaching at lots of different places, film, politics, British media, all these kind of different areas. I've been in at the Edinburgh Festival for a week, comparing for a double act. Yeah, it's been a busy summer, really, and just about to get back into a routine again, which I think will also be quite hectic.
And what sort of experience have you had have you had in your life that led you to this world of propaganda?
Well, I think the main thing was, that's a difficult question. I suppose from an academic point of view, I went into examining politics at an early stage in my life. And so propaganda was kind of a natural outgrowth of that because I did a master's in film. So that kind of married up film and politics for me. But I would say more generally for anybody who wants to, who has a moral sense and is concerned about propaganda, being lied to, being manipulated, the danger of warfare, those kind of issues, which I think comes from childhood, really, you know, the desire to have a better world, and the belief that we as a species might have the capacity to help create a bit of a better world, then, you know, to do that, you have to recognize that there's a lot of propaganda and lies around, which make that rather a difficult process to achieve. So, you know, I guess if you've got a moral sense, if you think it's important to act on that moral sense, then, you know, that's partly where it comes from as well.
Now, a lot of people, they're going to, you know, people like me that have been watching movies their whole entire life, it's going to be really hard for some people to even believe this or even venture to believe this. How did all of this start? How did they start having such a big influence on Hollywood?
It really shouldn't be that hard to believe that the government in some capacity has some effect on Hollywood movies. I mean, that's been known and is public for over a century now. Right back from the early days of cinema, the government had, you know, for example, when they lent even to the film, say, the earliest films, like, I've got the name of the movie now, the ones going back to the 1910s, even prior to World War One. You know, they were always lending out equipment and things like that, and in return for that, they want to have some kind of script changes. So I'm trying to think of the name of the racist film. Sorry, I've only just got in from a course. And Birth of a Nation, of course. So that was a film that was like a Ku Klux Klan recruitment movie, and you know, they needed some equipment from the military, so they asked the National Guard, and you know, so there's some cooperation that went on there. And just as time went by, the military became more and more powerful as an entity within Hollywood, and you know, more and more movie producers needed to go to ask for tanks and for men and advice and for men later on aircraft carriers and things like that. And so eventually, particularly during World War II and then the immediate aftermath, this suddenly became a really big thing. You know, they were making movies with close cooperation with the Department of Defense. What's a bit surprising is that, you know, we've all, you know, this has been public knowledge, that's no big secret. But what's surprising that Tom and I have brought out in this new book is the scale of that, because academics have routinely downplayed the amount of cooperation. And a lot of the documentation that shows script rewrites has been hidden. Or otherwise inaccessible, several movies have been left off the lists in the past, or have been just said, oh, you know, these are unacknowledged film cooperation, like basically secretly done. And then, of course, the story hasn't been updated for about 10 or 15 years at the least, in any capacity. And so there are several hundred movies left off there, and plus the about 900 TV shows that have suddenly been cooperated with by the military over the past 10 years, because there's been a sudden explosion of that since 2004, 2005. So there really shouldn't be any doubt that this has definitely happened. Everyone agrees on that. But it's the scale of it, and it's the amount of script rewrites that appear to have been conducted that is the is the shocker, really. And that's not really been known until mine and Tom's books have been out. Although last year there were three or four books on more narrower areas of this, like more specifically about the history of historical CIA cooperation with the Hollywood, for example, that did get chunks of this right. But we've really put that together, I think, now and with a new batch of documentation.
Now, looking at your bio here, it says that you applied Ed Herman and Noam Chomsky's propaganda model. What is this propaganda model? Would you mind telling us just a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. That's we don't really use that in the book directly, but that's been the sort of basis of a lot of my work, research in media. So, and I'm going to put this in sort of really blunt terms. Basically, Ed Herman and Noam Chomsky say, look, there are basically five major things that affect the content of media. Those and the content of media tends to be very, very sympathetic to powerful systems, whether that's the military, the White House, the state in general, capitalism, any kind of powerful entity that is kind of dominant in society. And that they say that those five factors are the concentration of ownership, the power of that, so that like how few owners there are ultimately of the media, the power of advertisers who can basically, their money dictates what gets on screen, the source of information, which often tends to be the government. Like if a journalist or whatever wants to write a story, they're always going to go to the government at some point because it's an easy way, in part because it's an easy way to get information. And then the fourth major factor is, powerful organizations, if they don't like what you've written about, what story you've told, they can give you some, they can cause some hassle to you. They can complain about you. They can orchestrate campaigns against you as a journalist or indeed a filmmaker or whatever. And then there's kind of, and then the fifth factor is kind of a more amorphous thing, sort of a dominant ideology of whatever it is. In their case, they often characterize it as a kind of the idea that the American government is benevolent, that kind of a priori assumption that society is good, if you like, or that the leaders in society are good. And, they wrote about that in a book called Manufacturing Consent. It's a very famous theory. In a way, it's a kind of, I don't know what else you want me to say about it, really, but it was, their work was very controversial because they were coming from a kind of anarchist perspective. But really, a lot of what they're saying is kind of common sense. You know, like the fact that the media is owned by a small number of very, very rich people, what a surprise. That's going to tend to mean that the media is quite sympathetic to very, very rich people. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Now, I remember a lot of stuff in TV shows when I was a kid. A lot of it had to do with anti-drugs, and AIDS was a big one back in the early 90s. Was this part of the Hollywood propaganda?
Drugs certainly has had input from government and Hollywood. The most sort of obvious case of that, and kind of scandalous case, was in the between the mid to late 1990s. There was a secret program under the Clinton administration, led by General McCaffrey, I think he was called, and they basically gave money. Technically, it was legal, but they had a pot of about $20 million, and they gave money to producers of TV shows, like, real slocky tea time TV shows like Beverly Hills 90210 and ER, and that kind of thing. And they gave them cash if they inserted anti-drug messages into their programs. So that's a really clear case. And then it was exposed by recent magazine called Salon in 2000, and then at that point the Clinton administration said, "Oh yeah, well we didn't mean any harm, we weren't doing anything wrong, but we're going to close down that program. And as is often the case, you know, when you expose propagandists, they do have to retreat because they know that they are being a bit naughty, really. You know, and it's like a lot of things to do with power. If you shine a light on them, then they run away like spiders.
And does this sort of technology, if you want to call it that, does it come from the Nazis and their propaganda?
That's an interesting link. Certainly the Nazis and the fascists and the Soviets were great pioneers of propaganda, and particularly propaganda in cinema. You may well have seen bits of films like Olympia and Triumph of the Will, which were made by Leni Riefenstahl, who was Hitler's major filmic propagandist, and making sort of the Aryan race look really glorious and so on, and quite innovative shots such as a plane that was carrying Hitler. You could just see the shadow of the plane on the ground, sort of flying over Germany, sort of giving him the sort of imperial image without him actually being seen for the first part of the film. So certainly, those kind of there is a long history of propaganda, and in particular that goes back to the early 1920s with PR and communication studies, those kind of things. And that was people like Walter Lippmann and Edward Bernays, who were basically pioneers of the advertising world. So, you know, like Mad Men, which I've only seen a few episodes of, which only recently, which is actually rather good. I feel like I should see it more. But Mad Men, the TV series, which you might well know, it's all these advertising people. Yeah, slightly later on, but from the 1950s. You know, they're all learning. They're all part of this sort of tradition of modern communication, which has been going on, you know, since sort of World War I. Propaganda's been going on for thousands of years, really. But the kind of modern take on it, the kind of mass media take on it, has been going on for about 100 years. And that parallels with, an early important examples of that were the totalitarian regimes in Europe. I wouldn't say that to slightly argue against myself there, I think, you know, it's not like there is anything that's quite as propagandistic and glorifying of the power of the American state as Triumph of the Will. Certainly not, you know, you're not seeing incredibly pro-dictatorship, pro-Donald Trump, sort of fawning major Hollywood movies. Hollywood movies typically try to be as hide their politics as much as possible, which I don't think you could really say was the case under Hitler. But nevertheless, that is still very much part of the context of what I'm talking about, the past 100 years or so of propaganda and how to sell a message.
And the Americans weren't exactly guiltless of this during the same time period. I know I've seen films of people watching movies during World War II, and they're showing these propaganda films before the film begins, where they're saying, you know, the dirty Japs or the Germans and stuff like that, really getting people angry about a particular group of people.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, then you have to ask the question, you know, what is propaganda for, and is it? Are there times at which it's justified for any reason? And perhaps a strict anarchist would say no, that you should always just sort of trust in human beings to, you know, do the right thing and, you know, fight in the right causes and so on. I find obviously World War II for a lot of people, myself included, is a hard one because, you know, you kind of did need to get rid of the Nazis. And maybe you need to like pump people up to do that using moving images. I don't know. I don't quite know exactly what could or should have happened in that circumstance. But I think if you look at the broader, if you place this in the broader political context, I think it is, and going back to what you asked me before about my background in politics, I mean, I think it's just undeniable that, you know, the last 25 years, and this isn't just post 9/11, but this is post Cold War, there's been no rational need for anything like the kind of powerhouse of brutality that has emanated from the American state. It's absolutely unjustifiable, and they certainly shouldn't be promoting it through through movies or through anything else. So yeah, all right, if there's an argument for it during World War II or, you know, Cold War or whatever, which also I think is nonsense, but let's say that there was, there's, you know, post 1989, you know, this is, there's no justification at all for any kind of lie on behalf of the American state. The American state should have been at the forefront of peacemaking in our global system. Instead, it was quite the opposite.
Are they trying to drive society in a particular direction?
That's a good question, Daniel, but I don't know, because you've got to, I mean, think who these people are. This isn't like, at least as far as we know, this isn't there isn't like a control group that's saying, you know, Pentagon do this, CIA do this, FBI do this, you know, we want this exactly to happen. Basically, these are PR organizations, public relations organizations within existing systems. They're not the head of the Pentagon or anything like that, although sometimes that kind of thing happens. Like, you know, some of the higher ups were really very much involved in, say, the film Zero Dark Thirty. But generally speaking, you know, you're not talking about, when we're talking about, you know, a couple of thousand products being affected, or thousands of products being affected, there's not necessarily a coherent strategy that is being implemented for the idea that they can make society radically different in any way. I mean, there might be some people in the government who hold those kind of delusions of grandeur, but basically you're talking about fairly normal PR organizations within the Pentagon and CIA and the others, who just are doing something that I think is morally wrong and unnecessary and unhelpful within society. Whether that's trying to drive a more sort of serious political agenda, shape society in a particular way, I'm a bit nervous about saying that. I guess the most I could say for that is that yes, they want to recruit people into the military, which is pretty, is bad enough, to be honest with you. And to recruit people into the CIA. And they do want to present the image of America being a benevolent organization. A benevolent country. And for these particular organizations to be presented in generally in benevolent ways. Whether there's a sort of more insidious or unexpected or sort of fascistic ideology that is going on there, that is being driven through entertainment, I think I'd be a bit wary of saying that. But like I say, certainly some, you know, there's always going to be your little Hitlers in any of these organisations who might have that kind of attitude. But as a rule, these are just sort of normal organisations within these bigger frameworks of power.
One movie that kind of stands out for me that I remember off the top of my head was the second Transformers movie, meaning the ones that were made recently by Michael Bay. In the second one, there seemed to be quite a bit of United States military action. A lot of it was out in the desert. There was military equipment being used. The Transformers themselves, they really needed the help of the U.S. military to defeat the enemy, which was strange because the enemy was the Decepticons, which were always what the Transformers were fighting. I don't remember them fighting alongside the military in the old cartoon or anything like that. Did you see that movie, and could this be an example of the same thing?
Yeah, I think that's a sure in what depth you've read our book, but Transformers is a section in there, and it's such a good case. So yeah, they didn't really need the U.S. military to win that fight against Decepticon. To be honest, I've watched some of the Transformers movies, and they all roll into one a little bit for me. I think Tom wrote that particular section, but I mean, it is so clear that that those that the Department of Defense was all over those productions, and I think that is the, I can't remember if it was Transformers 2 or 3, but they had started shooting one of the sequels before they had actually signed the contract with the Department of Defense to say, yeah, we're going to work on this together. And they'd also started shooting, I think, before they had a finished shooting script as well. So that is a kind of indication of what kind of movies they are politically, and how close the relationship was between the producers and the DOD. Basically, they were saying, you know, usually they'd have all the contracts all sorted out and make sure that, you know, everyone's in agreement as to how everyone's going to be presented and represented and so on. But in this case, they said, you know, we trust you and we know that you're going to do a great job to make all of our military gear and our military organisations look really, really good, and you know, we're really happy with that. So yeah, I think, I mean, your insights into the actual specific text of how that movie portrayed American power also sounds completely accurate, because they're very, very much pro the national security state.
And what movie directors or producers would you say are the worst offenders in terms of letting these messages be slipped into their movies?
Well, Michael Bay, who's obviously Transformers. Michael Bay's a major producer, very successful outside of that franchise as well. Also, Peter Berg is of a similar ilk to Michael Bay. He made films like The Kingdom. Peter Berg, sometimes I've got a bit of a soft spot for Peter Berg, which sounds ridiculous, but I know that he tried, he did his best on the film The Kingdom to find out about US-Saudi relations, because he was going to try and do a movie about that. But I think just the pressures of how to make, you know, how to make a movie, the kind of script that he got, the kind of advice that he was getting from not just military figures, but also Henry Kissinger's people on set. I think just ultimately he just didn't have the sort of intellectual interest, or well, he couldn't sustain that to make a more critical film. He ended up making a very propagandistic piece of work, pro-state, pro-dominant narratives. So those two are kind of big offenders. And then I'd say, you know, actually, I mean, as great a storyteller as he is, I mean, Peter Berg, wouldn't say he's a great filmmaker, really, and Michael Bay, popular, but, you know, he's not critically acclaimed, quite rightly so. But Steven Spielberg is also another, you know, made a lot of movies that are pretty sympathetic to the American national security state, and with a great deal of support from the Department of Defense. Captain Phillips, 3 or 4 years ago, was a movie made with Department of Defense support. But he sort of routinely works with the military. Of course, Spielberg was actually the executive producer on Transformers as well. So, and he received an award from the Department of Defense for his, I don't know the exact title of the award now, but like, you know, for assistance with, you know, U.S. military endeavors, or some award in the late 90s. And, you know, so Spielberg, for all of his great qualities and great imagination, everything he's brought to our culture, is unfortunately, I would have to include him in that list.
And this question is a little bit more of an opinion question, but could this be evidence of something like 9/11 being a cover-up, considering what they actually are able to get away with right under our noses?
Huh. Do you mean able to conceal a secret like this, it's indicative that the state is able to conceal other crimes.
Yeah, exactly. Because to me, I'm shocked hearing what they are able to get away with in terms of being able to slip things into movies. It definitely escapes the mainstream media attention. It just makes me wonder, maybe it is possible to cover up something like 9/11 and actually get everybody to shut up about it.
Well, I would say that without, I'm not making any particular judgment about 9/11, but I would say that the two things are, I think it's not a very good idea to compare those two things. I mean, compare the destruction of several buildings and several aircraft, not to mention several thousand people, and compare that with an unpleasant and unfortunate long-standing and technically public PR campaign from two or three major organisations. I think there's not such a good comparison to make. I don't think that one can inform the other. I suppose in broader terms, I would agree with you in the sense that I think it is worth being a bit paranoid about the American state and what it can do. I'd certainly say that, you know, being sort of flippant or at ease or assuming benevolence on behalf about the US government is not a good sort of first position to take on any issue, whether that's propaganda, i.e. just stuff to do with representation, or about things that have really happened in the world. I think if you're interested in something like 9/11, rather than comparing it to a kind of propaganda operation, it would be more worth your while comparing it to previous false flag operations, and attempted false flag operations, like, say, Operation Northwoods from the early 1960s, or the Gulf of Tonkin incident that triggered the escalation of Vietnam. Those kind of things. But yeah, broadly speaking, it certainly means that it's worth being more skeptical about movie representations, about news representations, and about American government activity in general than even before.
Okay, so we know that definitely in the United States, this is documented, this is factual. But how about other countries, like China, for example? Are they doing the same thing over there?
I mean, I haven't done a proper examination of those other countries. And it might well be that Tom and I, in the next couple of years, and we're not going to rush to it, but we may write some kind of article about manipulation of entertainment in other countries, probably with a particular focus on Britain, because we may actually get some new documentation from Britain, possibly about series like Spooks. I don't know if you ever saw that. I think it was given a different name. I think it was called MI5 or something like that in the States. So, yes, of course that happens in other countries. In fact, it kind of happens universally. There's certainly some kind of state involvement in British entertainment. China is obviously, at least, depending on how you want to characterise the system, but, you know, it wouldn't be unfair to call it a dictatorship or an autocracy. But obviously they control content of their media. They control the content of people's Google searches, for goodness sake. You know, they're certainly not going to be shy about editing a movie. And of course, they control not just the content of films in a country like China, but also whether films even get into the country. So, I mean, I can't remember the exact figures now, but for a long time, China only let in, I think, 18 Western films each year. 18 films. And now I think it might have gone up to about 25, but it's still very limited what they allow in access to their market. And, of course, there's changes that they make as well. I'm trying to remember the specific one, but they had... I think they had... there's lots of nice little examples in an article that came out a few months ago. But say, in the case of Iron Man, I think it was Iron Man 3, when the Americans sold Iron Man 3 to the Chinese market, the Chinese said, oh, we really want we want you to retain this scene, which they'd already chopped out, I think. And the scene was, you know, got some Chinese government scientists reviving Robert Downey Jr.'s character, and like some Chinese doctors. So they said, they were like, oh, yeah, we want that to be retained in the cut that we have. So there's lots of little changes that are made, even on American films that are going into the Chinese market. Of course, yeah, but all countries have their own kind of national cinema. In fact, you know, even in mainstream film studies, you know, it's common to say, even say South Africa has got its own national cinema, if you like, got its own kind of characterization, or France has got its own kind of French cinema, its own kind of similar familiar tropes and sort of style. What's unusual about the American experience, I think, is that A, it's not really called a national cinema, it's just called Hollywood, implying that it's kind of like a kind of global, you know, that it's got the universal stories, whereas actually a lot of these stories are very nationalistic and kind of, you know, embedded within the American experience. Not to say there's anything wrong with that, but it's much more nationalistic. It's nationalistic in the same way that all national cinemas are. And I think the other big thing about it is that the amount of government input is, I'd say, considerably greater in the United States because the Pentagon is so big, the military is so massive, and because the American market and the American producers seem to be so inclined to make very, very violent, warlike productions, and to therefore need the support of these massive, violent organizations. You know, the American state, as you know, as any empire, going back forever, is fascinated by its own conduct of violence and its own power, its own imperial rule. So it just so happens that it is a that that's the way its cinema has turned out, and of course, some of its TV as well.
And you just mentioned violence, and I have to ask, is violence, and most specifically desensitization of violence towards society, is that a big part of this, to just make us not care when we see something that would normally make us revolt?
Do you mean political violence?
Violence in general, or political violence, is that a big part of this? Just putting up a lot of imagery that would normally bother people, and just getting society to be maybe a little bit more warlike, and young people not minding going out there and joining the military and doing something that normally they'd be morally opposed to doing?
Again, my kind of reluctance to sort of see the world as quite that joined up comes in here. I think, again, I don't know how well coordinated that kind of plan is. You know, in the end, they've got a basic remit, these organizations: recruit people to our organizations, and point B, don't criticize the government while doing it. You know, that's basically it. I mean, there are other sort of objectives that they have, but you know, that's kind of where it comes down to. Now, that means that they're really important and really dangerous, but whether that means that they've got some kind of additional kind of secret directive that involves, you know, desensitizing society to violence or something like that, you know, that's not in the documentation. I mean, it might be subconscious in some of the people who are running these things, I don't know. But it's a bit more of a stretch. I mean, if anything, they want to dumb down the violence. They want to make violence look less real and less scary. That's why you've got, you know, things like Top Gun, for example, from 1986, the Tom Cruise movie, you know, all the violence in that, character dies in it, whatever, but, you know, you've got really kind of cartoonish violence, and you've got no real enemy in that film. It's all about just everyone looking really good, and planes looking really good, and, you know, you haven't got blood splattered on the floor, you know. So a lot of what the American propaganda apparatus is about is trying to make everything look less violent and more I'm trying to figure the right word now.
More cartoonish.
Cartoonish, yeah, or antiseptic. And so you know they get a bit less comfortable when you've got a film like, say, Full Metal Jacket. You know, the Stanley Kubrick movie come along, and suddenly it's all about, you know, like. You know, horrific training scenes and bullying and all those kind of things. They don't like that. And they don't like it when there's real stuff in it, like drugs, for example, you know, drug use amongst cadets, or alcohol abuse and those kind of issues. You know, they get uncomfortable with those kind of things because they're too close to the real world. They're not antiseptic enough. Your question, though, does also speak to a kind of a deeper thing, which is, very hard to sort of evidence, but the idea that perhaps having violence on screen may not be having anything on screen that is dangerous might act as a kind of safety valve for society. And so, actually, I mean, if you look at the new Tom Cruise movie, American Made, which I haven't yet seen. I don't think it's actually out in Britain yet, but I'll see it soon like that. But the that is about, it's to do with drug running by the American government. But as I understand it, they're presenting that drug running from the 1980s as a kind of dreamlike sequence. So there is the possibility, the potential, that through entertainment, you can create this kind of ethereal world of meaninglessness that means that any real political scandal can be kind of turned into something wispy and entertainment-y and candy flossy and nothing-y. And I think there is something in that, but that is not that's not written down. That's not kind of like standard government policy. I think there probably is something in that. That as soon as you put any kind of political issue through the entertainment meter, then you kind of automatically killed it. I saw a nice little clip. I'm sorry to mention Spooks again, because I know it's not an American show, so you guys may not be quite as familiar, but it has gone over to the States. But they had I saw a clip of that the other day, because in that TV series, they talk in detail about how Princess Diana was assassinated by MI5.
Oh wow!
And you know, this is a production that I think had some kind of input from MI5, even if only a little bit of advice or whatever. Tom Sacker has dealt with that in more detail himself, because he's obsessed with books, he's written a lot about it, and has asked for the information document. But, you know, they did, you know, a whole 5-minute reconstruction of exactly how that assassination happened. And you look it up on YouTube, and it's kind of bizarre because it's so convincing and so kind of beautifully done with diagrams and everything. But one wonders how much impact that would have on the public, on the public mood, or in a debate, because automatically it is already about these, you know, it's being told by these kind of lovable characters who are fictional. It's put into a safe space, into the world of entertainment, and therefore whatever you say in the world of entertainment is rendered kind of mute, is rendered useless. So the only thing that entertainment perhaps can be useful for is for the more malign things, the more dangerous things, like the things that affect your gut, like, oh, I should go and I should hate Muslims now because I've seen this production or whatever, you know, these series of messages. Or I should go and join the army or whatever. which I'd say are not, you know, not very positive things. Whereas actually genuine sort of intellectual critical things cannot actually have any impact through the silver screen. That's kind of a theory. I mean, I don't know, but that's the impression I get, because I've never seen anyone leave a cinema and say, now I'm going to go to a protest, or now I'm going to write to my own team.
So basically, it has to be done in a very sneaky, almost subconscious way, where it's not a direct thing that you should go out and think or you should go out and do. It's more trying to trigger certain feelings.
Yeah, and I mean, bear in mind, a lot of this, in terms of like the bigger messages, which may not be consciously thought through by the PR people, a lot of this is just the drip effect of years or decades of these kind of messages. So like the key message, and that one that comes back to the Herman and Chomsky propaganda model that we were talking about before, the main thing that they talk about is that it is about benevolence, about the idea that the state is essentially benevolent. And that's not to say that everyone thinks that everything that the American government does is decent and kind or anything like that, but it does. But the assumption is when the United States, or indeed these other Western powers or whatever, when we get involved in other countries, we are basically doing that for out of the goodness of our heart, for good reasons, you know, because we want to create stability, for example. Now, that kind of assumption underlies a vast swathes of popular culture, and particularly, of course, you know, newspaper news and TV news and so on. There is the general assumption, and it's not surprising, it's human nature. We want to believe that our society is doing the right thing by another society. You know, even when we were killing the neighbouring tribe 10,000 years ago, we wouldn't have been thinking, oh, we're going to do this because we want to nick their sacred tree or whatever. You know, we're probably going to be doing it because we think, oh, these people are savages, you know, or we need to protect ourselves or any of these other reasons. What's so unusual about the time in which we live in, I think, is that over the last quarter of a century, at least, but longer really, is that there's no rationale for that. It's nonsense. There is no threat from any organisation that justifies the kind of military expenditure and the kind of military and security services that exist in the Western world. We are enormously powerful. If there's one thing that Donald Trump has got right, is to express that enormous confidence in how powerful the United States is. And it's also one of the things, actually, sorry, I know you're from the States, but the likely prime minister in our country is actually a socialist, or near socialist, Jeremy Corbyn. And he also says the same thing. We're a rich country. We are a powerful country. And I think it's really good that leaders know that, because they should have that kind of confidence, because we are, as a hemisphere, as a civilization, we are enormously powerful. We shouldn't be afraid of other little countries, little tin pot dictatorships like North Korea. You know, we should be dealing with those situations in mature ways, because we are way beyond them, and we can protect ourselves in every possible way. And the only thing that can go wrong is, sorry, I'm ranting now, but the only thing that can go wrong is that we actually initiate these kind of wars and create enormous disasters for ourselves through our own making. That's what happened in Iraq, but that's what's been happening for three decades and beyond. Anyway, slightly off the point of movies, but it is all tied together, I think.
That does beg another question about North Korea. What's happening right now? Obviously, it's got the whole world up in arms. Do you feel that Kim Jong-un and his threats of nuclear holocaust and things like that, is this legitimate, or could this just be his propaganda?
Well, I mean, I think it's undoubted that North Korea has got a very effective propaganda apparatus in its own country, just as pretty much every country does. But the countries that need propaganda the most and need to lie to themselves the most are the most insecure countries. Most insecure countries, by that measure, appear to be the United States and North Korea. it certainly has been in the past. But, you know, there are all sorts of different ways to deal with terrorist organizations. You don't go and, because someone, you know, robs a pizza parlor down the street, doesn't mean you then go and bomb the street. You know, lots of different ways of dealing with these kind of things.
And what I should ask is, what are the opinions of Donald Trump over in the UK? Do most of you guys over there like him, or are most of you just kind of like many people over here, where you don't like him very much, or is it split? What are the opinions over there?
Very little support for Donald Trump outside of the United States, I think. I mean, where are you from, and what's your what's the demographic of your area?
I'm up here in Seattle, Washington. It's very, very liberal around here. Most people are very anti-Trump in my local area. And then down in the South, it's much different. It's much different in different areas. It's split all over the place. But in general, in the more liberal cities, are very anti-Trump. And in the Southern, more conservative states, they're very, very pro-Trump.
Yeah, yeah. In the outside world, from what I understand, certainly in Britain, hostility to Donald Trump. Most of it, I think, of course, is justified. But at the same time, I think, you know, people who dislike Trump but have, you know, never even paid a blind eye to what the Clintons did, or indeed, perhaps to some extent, what Obama did. You know, they're suddenly being woken up because in terms of rhetoric, Trump is such a obvious kind of turn-off for any normal human being. But, you know, these kind of problems, these kind of attitudes, you know, threats of nuclear annihilation and this kind of thing, you know, they've gone back deep into the 20th century and beyond the Cold War. I mean, there's not much of a... It was, well, in my opinion, we're talking away a little bit from our original focus, but my opinion, you know, there's only a cigarette paper or two between what Trump's done in foreign policy and what Hillary Clinton was done in the country. So I'm pretty uncomfortable with all of them. I don't assist him so much. I mean, I don't know. I might be wrong with that. I certainly saw a piece written just a few days ago that said that I think Trump had killed a couple of thousand more people through drone strikes than had been... you know, much higher rate than under Obama. So, yeah, I mean, I'm certainly uncomfortable with what Trump's done. I don't know what would have happened under Hillary. Certainly, her people were talking up the idea of an invasion of Syria right at the beginning of her expected administration. And that would have made me particularly uncomfortable. But, yeah, I'm certainly in the anti-Trump camp as well myself.
And much earlier in this interview, you had mentioned Steven Spielberg being among some of the worst offenders in this propaganda type stuff. And my question is, one of his most well-known movies, Close Encounters, was that movie meant to spread some sort of propaganda related to UFO and aliens?
Spielberg did Close Encounters, and I don't know if you have read it in any of my old stuff, but he said in an interview in 1977 that NASA had written him a 20-page letter prior to the release of Close Encounters saying, please, please do not release this film for all of these reasons. And it was mainly because, you know, a few years before he'd made Jaws and everyone had panicked about sharks being everywhere and being man-eaters and so on. And NASA was apparently worried that... the new film would mean that there would be a mass overload of UFO sightings in the United States. We contacted Spielberg asking for a copy of this letter, whether it existed or not, I don't know, maybe it was just publicity, whatever. Anyway, he didn't provide it, and we could not get it through NASA either. But supposedly there's this extensive letter from NASA about asking not to release the film. Whether that means that there was another letter or another directive on Spielberg asking him to do exactly what you're talking about, which is to kind of acculturate humanity or Americans, whatever, to the existence of aliens, I don't know. Certainly, if you go to, by far and away, the best
here by Silver Screen Sources by Robbie Graham, you will see extensive documentation of that idea that the government, or at least pockets of the military, sometimes mess around with the heads of producers. So, and this goes for TV series like Dark Skies, it goes for a documentary in the 70s called UFO Past, Present, Future, where they basically do things like, oh, we'll promise you footage of real alien landings, and then they show the producers bits of alien landings, and then they, you know, the tapes don't ever then properly turn up and can't be properly used. There's all sorts of, there are several instances basically of some very weird mind games being played by senior intelligence and military figures with producers of UFO related entertainment content. That, to some extent, involved Close Encounters of the Third Kind, but also several other productions. Even that movie, the kids' movie from a few years ago, I've got the name of now, Escape to Witch Mountain. You know, they apparently had tours. You have to go to Robbie's book, really, because I can't remember the details. But you know, they had a tour inside the massive nuclear shelter, but you know, by like an unnamed senior, like government official, that they brought the film makers into that space, showed them around loads of areas that they weren't supposed to see, and there's lots of cloak and dagger stuff going on with that. It is a fascinating story, but it's hard to pin down exactly what it all means. So Robbie does it then.
How about the Terminator franchise? Is there a message there?
Well, the Terminator franchise I find particularly annoying because people from my generation and maybe beyond as well will remember Terminator 1 and 2 being particularly good films. I mean, they were, you know, some of the best films of the 80s and 90s. And indeed, I thought that Terminator 3, although a lot of people have gone off it by then, I thought Terminator 3 was a really terrific film. Albeit unfortunately lacking Sarah Connor, Linda Hamilton. But by Terminator 3, there had started to be a little influence by the Department of Defense, because they had provided a little bit of equipment, I think. They didn't actually influence it in any direct way, because I think they were basically happy with the way that they... The Brewster character, the guy who's running the nuclear weapons, was, I think, initially... had a slightly different character, and then they tweaked him slightly, but I don't think the DOD actually was instrumental behind that. But then by Terminator 4, there was massive involvement, and you look at the script of that, and it's just so depressing. Terminator 4 Salvation just reads like a joining the army brochure. It's one of the most miserable films I've ever seen. And it's so unrealistic, they just go so far away from the... from the original spirit of the movies, which are very kind of anti-nuclear, for example, very anti-technology, very anti-government, anti-authority, sort of pro-humanity. And instead, Terminator 4 was just this very kind of by-the-numbers, nuclear weapons going up left, right, and centre, but no one gets affected by that. The war is just basically okay, really. It's just another bomb. I found Terminator 4 particularly disheartening. They have a full heart transplant in open air when there's supposed to be threatening Terminator land in the last scene. It's just like, it's just a
poor film. But it's partly a poor film, not just because of the fact that the franchise ran on too long, but also because the military was involved in crafting it, so it became dull. As a lot of as is typically the case, if you get PR people, you get advertisers coming in to try and make something creative. Generally speaking, they're not interested in making it good. They're interested in selling their product.
And for all of the concerned people out there, and people that are concerned, of course, for their children. What can we do to prevent ourselves and our kids from being influenced by this propaganda?
Uh, Well, I think you first of all have to understand what it's saying. I mean, if you're from a, you know, if you're from a military family, and if you believe in those kind of things, then I'm not going to get through to you on that level anyway. But I certainly wouldn't want people to not watch films that are there. I mean, I personally would let my children watch pretty much anything. I think it's just about being critically aware, you know. And, you know, and I guess an important thing is you mentioned children, it just makes me think, oh, I've got to be more responsible in my answer. But I suppose I would say if you can watch programs, particularly programs that are overtly have political themes of some kind, if you can watch them with your children, even if only once, then at least you can have a dialogue with them about what that means. But, you know, one film here and there about, you know, that shows the military blowing something up is not going to, you know, suddenly, you know, your son isn't going to suddenly go out and make a nuclear bomb. You know, you've got to take these things with a bit of a pinch of salt. It's the drip effect. It's the scale of the operation, like Tom and I are saying in the book. You know, you've got thousands of products that have done this over a period of just over a century. And that's what matters. It's how it affects society en masse, not how it affects little Johnny, who's, you know, 12 years old. You know, your kids are probably going to be okay, but like as a whole, statistically, society is going to be damaged by this kind of product.
Sure, definitely. And being that, Matthew, being that you are somebody that, from what I can tell right away, is that you have some very strong opinions as to the quality of some of these movies, aside from the propaganda aspect. And what I want to ask you is, this is more of a personal question, but what are some of the movies that you would give a thumbs up to? What are some of your favorite movies of all time?
I find that a really hard question, but I'm going to give you... I've always struggled with that question because I think that variety is the important thing in life, and that actually to hang on to one particular film or one particular song or whatever it is makes me a bit uncomfortable. But I would say I really like completely trashy comedy that has got nothing to do with politics. You know, away from that, I don't really want to be reminded of anything political. I like screwball stuff like Beavis and Butthead or something like that. Or even, I watched the other day on TV the Cameron Diaz movie, Bad Teacher, and I just find her hilarious. And, you know, something like that is just a total distraction. That's kind of what entertainment's meant to be. It's meant to be a distraction. I don't really think that movies should be kind of obliged to do anti-propaganda. So as much as I admire many of the films of Oliver Stone or even Paul Verhoeven, and we discuss in detail in the book, or indeed some of the Tom Clancy movies of the original source, the original material he wrote anyway, you know, as much as I admire them, I don't really want to watch them. I want to watch some daft thing that takes me away from the world and brings levity and joy. And the one that really made me laugh the other day was Cameron Diaz being a horrible elementary school teacher or whatever it happened to age now. But you know, it just made me laugh, and I prefer things like that than anything serious. I mean, occasionally, you know, there are political films that are just great, or war films that are made that are just particularly good. But I don't know. I mean, have you got an answer to that question yourself?
Well, in terms of movies about war, this one might have been a little bit of a propaganda film, but I really love that Mel Gibson movie, Hacksaw Ridge. It just blew me away.
Again, a particularly sort of brutal one as well. So, I guess I could like that, but it's not quite my thing.
Well, fair enough. And Matthew, we are approaching the end of the interview, but I did want to go ahead and just open things up one more time and give you an opportunity to just get on that soapbox one more time if you'd like, and feel free to follow that up with any plugs you might have, anything at all you might want to promote.
Well, that's really sweet of you. Thanks. I don't really want to shove things down anyone's throat, to be honest with you. I mean, you're very welcome to get hold of National Security Cinema which is unfortunately only available by Amazon at the moment. I think Tom's seeing if he can work a way around that. And the subtitle is The Shocking Evidence, Shocking New Evidence of Government Control in Hollywood. But yeah, I mean, that's the main thing that we're trying to sell, and I think people will enjoy it if they read it as a whole. And you're welcome to take a look through the free look inside function on Amazon as well. And you're welcome to, oh, I guess the other thing I can say is if you want to click like on my kind of blog, Facebooky thing, which is The Writer With No Hands, then you're welcome to click on that. And I put out news stories and sometimes my opinion on different things through that.
Okay, awesome. And I had a great time talking to you this morning, or it's evening for you, but I'd definitely like to do it again at some point in the future.
Oh, that's really sweet of you. Well, I had a really nice conversation as well. Thanks very much. It's been quite a long day, and it's actually a really easy conversation, so I appreciate what you've done.
Yeah, absolutely. And you enjoy the rest of your evening, and I will talk to you in the future.
That'll be lovely. I look forward to that. Thanks very much indeed, Daniel.
Bye. And that was Matthew Alford, who is writing some very excellent books and articles on this topic. I highly recommend you just Google his name. There's another Matthew Alford out there, but he's involved in something completely different. So make sure you get the right one. That's the one from the UK. You'll find him on Amazon. I believe he has a website of his own as well, and talks with him on YouTube. So very easy to find his information. I do apologize, the connection, I mean, you gotta remember that we're actually communicating with somebody that's all the way in England, so you can't really expect that the call quality is gonna be that awesome, right? You can't expect it to be, like, perfect. So a lot of times when we do interviews that are so far away, it actually will sound like that. There'll be a lot of Skype interference and stuff like that, so I just hope that you guys are able to hear all of that, and I do apologize for the call quality, but that's really the best we can do without me flying over to England with a laptop and a microphone and all that, and hopefully I will be able to do stuff like that one of these days. Unfortunately, the call quality isn't always really easy to hear, and I was doing my best to be able to hear and decipher everything myself. So once again, I apologize if that was a little hard to hear. And a big thank you to Matthew for joining us today. Obviously, he's a very busy guy. He was just coming back from doing a talk, and it's getting late in the evening for him. So big thank you to him for joining us. I do like these shows where our guest is from the UK, because it always forces me to do the show in morning. So instead of being all tired and burnt out and raging into the night, I'm raging into the morning, sitting here with my cup of coffee. So it's a very different feel. I kind of like the morning radio feel, but I love going deep into the night as well and having the stars and the moon above and that creepy sort of fog. I actually live next to a cemetery, so it's very creepy right here. Very spooky. It sets the mood quite well. But let's go ahead and take a break. We still have a lot of show to do, but let's go ahead. I'm talking fast because of the caffeine. We still have a lot of show to do, so let's go ahead and play some music, and we will be back here after the break.
Raising consciousness and awakening mankind. This is End of Days Radio.
welcome back to End of Days Radio. This is Daniel, and I'm sailing aboard the Black Ship into the night, or into the day, I should say. Welcome back to End of Days. This is our wrap-up and news period of the show. This is the portion of the show that a lot of you guys out there, you actually are waiting for this part of the show. Like, this is your favorite part. You are just waiting on pins and needles for the wrap-up and news section, and here we are. We have quite a bit to talk about today. Remember, if you want to call in, you can call in at 209-348-9810, or just add NinjaShoe777 on Skype. As usual, all that I ask is you let me get started with the guest. Let me go about 15-20 minutes before you call in, and then you can call in at any point during the show. So if you want to do that, that's 209-348-9810, or add NinjaShoe777 on Skype. And if you just want to connect with me to talk, that's fine too. If you want to leave a funny message or a voicemail, or, you know, introduce me to some music or whatever it is, a news story, fan mail, you can send at DanielEndOfDaysRadio@gmail.com. I love reading your mail on air. In fact, I do have, there's so much to talk about today. I don't know if I have time for all of this. Okay, so I'll go ahead and start off by reading an email, and this one is negative, so I'll just start off by saying that. Okay, this comes from Don. He says, "Dear Daniel, quit talking crap about Alex Jones. He is a hero, or the people." I'm guessing he means of the people. So he is a hero of the people, and you are just jealous because you believe in stupid crap, and Alex keeps it real. And that's from Don. Well, first of all, Don, thanks for writing me. I do welcome all comments or ideas, whether it's positive or whether it's a little bit more negative, like this particular one is right here. I don't agree. So I'll start off by saying that. I don't agree that Alex keeps it real. I find that that statement is completely contradictory to the truth. On my last show, I talked about Alex coming to Seattle, making fake videos of people throwing coffee in his face. Another example might be when he ambushed the Young Turks show. Now, don't get me wrong, I don't like the Young Turks at all. I don't like that political news platform, whatever it is. It seems very liberal biased, and I don't know much about it. But what I do know is hijacking someone else's broadcast to put yourself over is pathetic, it's rude, and it says it all. If you can't even muster the small amount of respect to not go and hijack and ambush another person's fucking broadcasting platform, and you think that whatever nonsense you're on about is more important than theirs, no. I don't care if you're a big conspiracy person or whatever. You don't have a right to hijack another person's broadcast. That's their thing. They built up their audience doing their thing. Their audience wants to hear what they have to say. And all that he was doing was trying to get more people to watch his thing. He's trying to troll his way into more viewers or listeners and more money, etc., etc. He's trolling. Now, why would I take somebody seriously who is trolling? That is 15-year-old behavior. I'm not saying adults don't do it, but that's what it is. It's 15-year-old behavior. And if you are a fan of Alex Jones and you listen to all of his stuff, then you're probably new to conspiracy and you're in the process of learning, which is fine because that's how I got started, watching Alex Jones eating up every word that came out of his mouth. That's when I was on the fence and I didn't fully believe in this stuff or not. I was on the fence. I didn't fully believe in it. I did not believe it, but I was curious, and Alex Jones was the starting point. And I think that there is a certain amount of immaturity involved in even listening or watching Alex Jones, because there's tons of videos and tons of evidence out there of him being rude to people, ambushing people, yelling and screaming on air, turning red in the face, saying ridiculous things about Russians doing this or that, Y2K. He's been wrong so many times. And to even support him, you have to support that type of trolling, that type of hijacking other people's broadcasts, lying, manipulating, selling things and trying to get viewers and talk about conspiracies just to sell things, you know, being a snake oil salesman. So, Don, I think you need to look at yourself, and I think you need to think about why are you so addicted to this particular program. And I think, Don, you need to ask yourself why you would follow anybody at all. I highly recommend you think for yourself. And I'm not saying, of course, I'm not saying listen to me or follow me. I mean, I'd love if you listen to my program or subscribe to it, but I'm not saying you have to agree with anything that I'm saying. If you just listen to this program for entertainment, that's completely fine. But yeah, I do think Alex Jones is stupid. I think he sucks, especially lately. Before, he used to be more deeper into the conspiracy stuff, but I think that he sucks now. And I think that if you choose to follow him and support him, you are going to lower yourself in order to be his fan. You know what I mean? Because if you're sitting there watching Alex Jones, you're doing that instead of reading a book or watching something that might be more educational. You're getting sucked into the Alex Jones platform and his frame of mind and his paradigm. You're getting sucked into that and you're staying there. And see, you say he keeps it real because he doesn't talk about aliens and super soldiers and psychic abilities and hauntings and stuff like that. Well, no, I don't think that's keeping it real. I think that's doing the opposite. That's keeping people down at the level of 3D material, in-your-face type of conspiracies that go on with government and stuff like that. It's leaving out the alien aspect, the spiritual aspect, which ties right back into the black budget and the secret societies and the government. So you're only getting a slice of the pie. So I think that's immature of you to follow Alex Jones. You need to grow up and expand your perspective, and maybe you need to look at the opposite end. Maybe you need to look at the non-conspiracy stuff in the news, the normal sort of shit, or maybe you need to look at some of the more spiritual or alien or stuff like that, because you're stuck there. You're stuck where I was in the past, and I evolved from that. So me seeing that you are still in that paradigm, I'm encouraging you to expand and get out of that paradigm and expand and grow and become a little bit more of an evolved conspiratard. if you want to use that word, conspiratard, but you got to be a more evolved conspiratard like I am. My foil hat has extra points on it. It's a 7-point foil hat to bring in the end of days. Okay, enough of this. Let me start off by saying that, of course, this program, this is not where we discuss pro wrestling or MMA fights and stuff like that. I have a separate show that I have, like, not even been working on at all because I've been so focused on End of Days. But I don't normally talk about pro wrestling or MMA stuff on this show, or boxing or kickboxing or anything like that, because, well, there's a lot of female listeners and a lot of listeners that are more the intellectual type, and not to say that females don't love that type of stuff, because plenty of them do. But I tend to like to stick to what the audience wants to hear, which is paranormal related stuff on this program. But everybody watched that fight. Everybody watched Floyd versus McGregor. So I'm going to just talk about it very briefly. I thought it was a great fight. I had no regrets at all for watching that fight. I thought that McGregor really took it to him at the beginning. He looked great. He made Floyd look slow. He looked old. Of course, he looked much better later on, but you cannot deny the fact that McGregor was dancing around him. He was touching him up. He looked like the better boxer of the two, which says a lot because he's not a boxer. He's an MMA fighter. And just the fact that an MMA fighter was able to go in and fight one of the best boxers of all time in boxing. This wasn't an MMA fight, it was boxing. The fact that he was able to outbox the best boxer, one of the best boxers that has ever lived, that says a lot for MMA. I mean, that says that an MMA fighter's hands are not that much far behind a boxer's hands. I'm not a boxing guy. Like, I'll watch it sometimes. I know a little bit about it, but I'm mostly a fan of MMA. So obviously I'm probably a little bit biased, but I feel that that fight and everything that happened, I feel it did a lot more for MMA rather than taking away from it. And hats off to both men. You know, I'm not sure what type of guy
Floyd Mayweather Jr. is. I've heard of allegations of spousal domestic abuse and stuff like that. I can at least say that he's a great fighter. I don't know what type of person he is. He doesn't seem like the type of person that I would want to support or follow based on what I've heard. But I have seen many of his fights and a lot of clips from his fights. I watched the match with De La Hoya. And the guy, he's just so fast. He does things in the ring that no one else has been able to. But as far as his personal life, I don't like him very much. I don't like his personality or his, any guy that would hit a woman or do anything like that. I can't support somebody like that. And McGregor, of course, has a big mouth. He has a big honking-ass mouth. But he uses it to sell fights. He knows what he's doing, and he's a great fighter. He's gone in there and he's beat everybody in MMA. He's still dominant in the sport of MMA, and he still reigns supreme. So he's got plenty of fight left in his career. So I wish him all the luck. Definitely a supporter of his. I think his next fight might be against Nate Diaz. So we'll see how that all turns out. And I'd love to see a rematch with Floyd. I mean, I think that a rematch would have just as many people watching it as the first fight. So a smart move for them would be to go ahead and do a rematch there. And I apologize to all of you out there that hate fight sport talk. I know some, back in the old days, I get so many complaints about, like, let's not talk so much about pro wrestling. I know that seems insane, right? Why talk about stuff like that on a paranormal program? But, you know, when you're first starting out, you don't realize stuff like that. You just kind of talk about whatever you want to talk about. But let's see here. There is plenty I need to get to here, so I'm going to keep it moving. We got a few news stories. Obviously, the hurricane in Texas, a very scary thing that's going on. My prayers go out, and I am ashamed that I can't do more to help. What more can I say? I wish I was able to hop in my truck and head down there and actually help with some of the relief efforts, but it's not something I'm able to do right now. I can't just drive down there. I'd have to take a plane. I'd have to get the time off. So I would really highly encourage anybody out there that wants to go volunteer and help them. Every person that's down there helping, every body makes a difference. So I think that anything that you can do, if you want to donate money or if you want to go down there and help personally, I really, hats off to you. And the other thing, and this is what I really wanted to talk about, was this minister, Joel Osteen, however you say his name. He actually closed the doors of his church to the people who needed help. And oh my God, is that disgusting or what? He has these big churches that can hold thousands and thousands of people, and he would not help with the rescue efforts. And I guess he made some kind of statement that his organization is not going to be controlled by social media. So two big fat thumbs down for you, Joel Osteen. It's my understanding this guy makes quite a bit of money, and it's all from people donating in the name of religion. So all of these poor, unfortunate souls that have grown up with a Christian sort of upbringing that believe in what he's preaching, he must be a smart guy because he's gotten all of these people to give him money for no reason, just because they think he's a good guy. They support the church. They support the effort. He's got a whole hive mind set up, a whole following of people that will give him money for no reason at all. So he must be a pretty smart guy if he was able to do that. But smart and good don't necessarily go hand in hand. He's obviously a very evil individual. And if you actually look at photos of this guy, if you Google Joel Osteen, Osteen, he's one ugly, fox-faced, demonic, satanic, reptilian-looking motherfucker. I mean, this guy is one ugly bastard. I'm no Tom Cruise, I'm no Brad Pitt, but this guy's an ugly motherfucker. His eyes look like he's possessed by Satan himself. I swear I'm looking at a picture of Beelzebub. He has the most ratty, fox-faced, snake-eyed look that I've ever seen on a person. And I don't attack people's looks or anything like this or anything like that, but you can see the evil just radiating from this guy. It's like it's almost reflecting in the way that he looks. And maybe he is some kind of reptilian or some kind of possessed motherfucker or something like that. Who knows? But shame on you, Joel Osteen, for not helping with those relief efforts. Shame on you. Shame on your organization. Shame on anybody that donates money to that organization. Hopefully this will help people wake up and they'll stop giving their money to religious scams. Keep in mind, nobody has any connection with a higher source. Nobody does. We all have an equal connection to a higher source. So there's no reason to give your money to any organization or any individual, because they are not able to do anything that you're not able to do. You have all the same connections to a higher power or a lower power. You don't need anybody to be there for you to bridge that gap and make that connection. And hopefully, like I was saying, something like this will help people kind of wake up that might be part of that organization. Maybe they'll see finally what it's really all about. It's just all about one guy and his family getting all the money and being superior in this life rather than doing what the Bible actually says. You know, the whole thing about it being harder for a rich man to get into heaven than for a camel to go through an eye of the needle. You would think that they wouldn't leave that whole part out of their whole philosophy and everything that they do, right? But unfortunately, Christianity and other religions, cults, a lot of these psychic people, they are just scammers. They just want your money. And that's the bottom line. Okay, let's move on because we don't have too much time here. So the other thing in the news is this Friday, a 4K remastered version of Close Encounters of the Third Kind will premiere in theaters nationwide. We were just talking about that earlier. The 1977 Steve Spielberg classic turns 40 this year. Congrats. And considering how closely the specter of this apocalypse looms, over America, I don't know about that, it's high time to revisit one of the first mainstream films to imagine how humanity might react to a visit from some extraterrestrials. But for some fans of the film, a 4K remaster isn't enough. From September 14th to 16th, a horde of UFO enthusiasts will congregate at Devil's Tower, the Wyoming rock formation featured prominently in the film. So I thought that was funny when I was looking at the news yesterday. I thought that was funny because here they're actually trying to do the same thing in the movie. Do you think that they're sitting there with their mashed potatoes and trying to make little Devil's Towers? I don't know if I agree with or recommend that sort of behavior. I think that it's been my experience that interactions with aliens or entities or anything like that, it's very permission-based. They seem to need some sort of invite from you in order to insert themselves into your life. I haven't really heard of any stories of anybody going to a mass UFO sighting or anything like that and then being abducted or tortured by aliens. But in general, I think it's a bad idea to just go out there and stand out there with an open invitation for any sort of extraterrestrial with superior technology and superior psychic abilities and superior intellect. I don't think it's a good idea to just put yourself out there and say, you know, come and do whatever you need to me or anything like that, because you don't know what you're dealing with. And I think that open approach to alien contact, like we saw in Close Encounters, for one thing, it's my opinion that they're already here. They've already been here for quite a long time, and they're already all tied up into our black budget and our government, only at a very, very deep level. I'm sure most don't know anything about it, as well as there being the possibility that these extraterrestrials or entities might be involved in secret societies at the highest levels. Who knows? But I don't think that the Close Encounter scenario is realistic. I don't think it would ever happen, simply because I think that they are already here. They've already been here. And if they were going to land and shake our hands and say hi, they would have already done it. So I think that going out and trying to meet aliens is kind of goofy. They're never going to show up. You're probably just lonely. You know what I mean? Like, you just want to meet other alien heads. Other people that are into aliens and UFOs, and share your enthusiasm over the film, which is fine, which is completely fine. If you want to share your enthusiasm, but don't expect anybody else to show up. I just don't think that disclosure is going to happen that way. And it doesn't, and to be fair, it doesn't specifically say that these people are going out there to meet aliens. I can only assume that they're copying the movie, but they might just be enthusiasts of the film and might want to share how much they love that mashed potatoes Devil's Tower. That's a good movie, though. Don't get me wrong. It's a fantastic movie. The whole idea of people gaining this connection with the aliens and then going out there to meet, I do think that there is some reality there. Have you guys seen Starman? I think that was made in the 80s. That's another good movie from that time period where there's alien stuff going on. And that one, I think, has some connections to real life as well. But there's that. There's the news for the day. Let's see here. And no, I'm happy to inform all of you that no reptilians have met my challenge. As you know, on my last show, I issued an open challenge to the reptilian race to find a champion among their people, or one of the reptilian races, so any one of them. I issued an open challenge to find one of their most physically fit, heroic, strongest fighters of their race, and to meet me in mutual unarmed combat, and fight boxing or MMA rules. They can pick. I said that they could use their tail, but they cannot use their claws or their teeth because that would be unfair. I think using the tail is fair because that's a natural appendage and they might have trained to use the tail. So for me to not allow them to use the tail, that would be a handicap. But I did have that open challenge out there and no one has responded. So take that for what it's worth. Looks like we got a call. Hello.
Hey, Daniel.
Hey there, buddy.
What's going on, my man?
Not much. I was just telling the audience out there how no reptilians have answered my challenge to engage me in mutual combat.
No response on that yet, huh?
Yeah, I mean, some people might see that as evidence for there not being any reptilians, or perhaps they just find my challenge to be frivolous and are not answering for other reasons.
Well, maybe we could get somebody to dress up like a reptilian and stage the whole thing.
Well, I'm not doing that. I might get my butt kicked.
There you go.
This way I'm going to be safe, because what are the chances of anything actually answering my challenge?
Yeah.
I mean, if some guy's wearing a suit, he might actually hit me. That's not good.
True.
And hey, I'm willing to sacrifice my body and get beat up to actually meet a reptilian and be able to prove their existence, but I'm not going to just let some average schmo hit me. No way.
I hear you. Right on. So, anyways, I had to call in for your news roundup.
Oh, right on. Did you hear any of it? Do you have any thoughts that you want to share? Maybe anything about this? Go ahead.
You go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying the things I talked about. I talked about the hurricane, and I talked about the gathering that's going to be happening at Devil's Tower in Wyoming based on the Close Encounters movie.
I haven't seen any pictures of Joel Osteen. I guess I should go look up some pictures of that guy.
Oh, yeah, that was
pretty weird looking, huh?
Yeah, that was the other thing. He's one of these guys that has this whole organization underneath him, and it's very obvious that it's just a money thing. It's just about getting people to donate and presenting a certain image. And an event like this just really shows the true colors. He obviously did not want to have to pay the power bill or whatever to help these people.
Yeah, sounds like your average TV evangelist, which they have a lot of those down there.
Yeah, exactly.
Your guest was sure interesting on the propaganda in the movies. Had a tough time making out some of his responses, though. It's like his phone would get further away, the sound would get lower as he was getting deeper into his topic. So there's a couple points there where it was hard to make out what he was saying, but pretty interesting.
Yeah, I think so. I normally would usually go another 15 to 30 minutes with a guest, but being that he was coming all the way from England and the connection wasn't particularly good at this time, I just kind of ended it just slightly short. But I know what you mean. I was having a hard time hearing some stuff, and I do apologize to everybody for that, but hopefully hopefully everybody out there was able to get something from that. I know I definitely did.
Yeah. No, it was interesting. My take on that, as far as my understanding goes, is in 2013, our government reversed a ban on propaganda in the United States. That they had a ban in the United States on propaganda since World War II, which they reversed in 2013 officially, so that now they could come out and use propaganda officially.
Yeah, that's completely ridiculous. Like I was saying to the guests, I've seen this stuff in the Transformers movie, and also one thing I forgot to mention was the Batman movie, the one with the Joker. There was a big message of NSA type of spying using mobile devices and things like that. And that, you know about that?
Yeah, well, I've seen that. When I was watching the movie, I could see it. I'm going, look how they're presenting Batman as this hero that's using this technology to spy on everybody. And so at the end of the movie, there was the dilemma with Morgan Freeman, where Morgan Freeman's like, I'm quitting then, because this is illegal, right?
Yeah, and Morgan Freeman probably would do that in real life.
Yeah, well, the movie had the propaganda in that movie is propaganda for, like, the vigilante. Like, he's a hero, you just don't understand him, so he's got to go do stuff in the darkness now.
He's going to do the things that everybody else is afraid to do, because he's got the balls to cross the lines and do what really needs to be done.
Yeah, and he's the hero. And so the police are chasing him on the one hand, but they really need his help. And can you see the propaganda?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, anytime you're justifying any sort of spying or anything like that, and like you said, the idea that he's doing it from behind closed doors, and this idea that it's okay to do things from behind closed doors. Batman would never do anything like that. Batman just beats up the criminals. He uses batarangs. He doesn't use guns. He's very ethical and fair. I found that to be a huge departure from the character. And one of which, as a Batman fan, I'm very disgusted.
Well, I think that they were slipping that in, though, because that's what they're doing. They're breaking the law in secret, pretending that they're the good guys, and that they have to break the law because criminals don't respect the law anyways, you know. Can you see the propaganda?
Yeah, definitely. And I wouldn't be surprised if the follow-up movie, the one with Bane, I wouldn't be surprised if that had some messages in it as well. I'm not sure what the messages might be, but the idea of a terrorist setting up this big bomb in a stadium and threatening everybody and nuclear weapons being involved, it seemed very relevant to the times.
Oh, totally. I'll tell you one other movie that was a great example of propaganda. And it was that Zero Dark Thirty. I don't know if you've seen that or not.
You know, I apologize. Everybody's telling me to watch that. I still have not seen that. But go ahead. Don't worry about spoilers.
I did not watch it either. I haven't seen it either, but I know all about it. And they gave the person, the woman that made the movie, an award, which may have been rescinded afterwards because they had to admit that the whole movie was propaganda. That they were using, Sean Penn was one of the heroes in there that's torturing, I forget the guy's name, Al-Akari or whoever the terrorist guy is. And in the movie, Sean Penn's telling him, I'm going to break you. You're going to tell me where the bomb is or whatever, you know. It's the same plot as 24, the TV show 24.
Uh-huh.
And the propaganda in the movie was that the torture got valuable information and helped us get Osama bin Laden or whatever, you know. When in actuality, the people involved in the torture, some of the closest people that were even in the government torturing people, said it doesn't work. And it produces the opposite effects. And that they get better information from befriending the person and trying to talk to them than torturing them.
Yeah, I don't doubt that at all. I imagine some of it must have been done to make the movie more dramatic, of course, but I've said this many times on this program, they never showed us a body. They never showed us anything that would resemble proof that Osama bin Laden was actually killed. They just sort of told us that it happened, and they had Hillary Clinton in a room with a bunch of other politicians supposedly watching video footage of it and trying to obviously cover their tracks, the same way they dumped the body into the ocean, obviously to cover their tracks, and they have all sorts of excuses for it. But I'd really like to see a body. I'd like to see one shred of evidence. I mean, people, they always tell me, oh, Daniel, you have no proof of these strange beliefs that you have. You don't have proof. You're a foil hat wearing paranoid conspiracy theorist, but yet they can't offer me any proof that this man actually died.
Yeah. Yeah. And I find the whole thing suspicious that, that this guy is over in the desert, running this vast, dangerous operation, terrorist operation, and we can't locate him for years and years and years, even though we were giving him money in the beginning.
But a film crew is able to find him.
Yeah, CNN's goes inside his cave and is interviewing him.
Yeah, and let's not forget that...
It's too much.
Let's not forget that William Cooper, before 2 months before 9/11 even happened, he said that they were planning on something, and it's going to involve Osama bin Laden, and it's going to happen soon, and it did, and he foretold the future, and now he's dead.
Yeah, and, you know, Cooper's scariest message was, they're bringing in a system of control that if they get it into place, it'll be the most oppressive system the world's ever seen. And that they're bringing it in secret, and they're using the terrorist threat to install it. You know, so he was way ahead of that, boy, because that's where we're at today.
Hey, Todd, do you want to help with the mind-blowing moment of the day?
Oh, totally, totally. I wanted to also mention real quick, Daniel, I love that Lovecraft, John L. Steadman show, that Lovecraft show. Please have him on again, yeah.
Oh, yeah, definitely. In fact, I'll try to find some other guests that can speak about that topic as well.
Yeah, yeah. What's the mind-blowing moment of the day, my man?
So the mind-blowing moment of the day, that's when we kind of say, oh, my God, you're blowing my mind, man. We try to sound like a hippie or somebody like Tommy Chong, like your mind's being blown. Do you think you could do something like that for me? Dude. Just say, man, you're blowing my mind.
That's fucking wild, dude.
Yeah. Holy shit, you're blowing my mind, man. Wow.
My mind's been blown.
Holy shit. Wow.
What was it?
Okay, so today's mind-blowing moment of the day, I'm going to go ahead and say it's when our guest Matthew Alford, he mentioned that NASA had actually written a letter to Steven Spielberg about Close Encounters of the Third Kind. We didn't have any absolute proof of that, but it seems like there's quite a bit of buzz around that. So I'm going to go ahead and say that's the mind-blowing moment of the day. And I suppose you could say that the revelation about MI5 and the Princess Diana, the reenactment of a possible assassination plot, I think that would be almost equally as mind-blowing. So those two things are the mind-blowing moments of the day today.
Right on, dude. Right on. Excellent show, my man.
Yeah, he just blew my mind, man.
Hell yeah. My mind's been blown.
Blow my mind, blow my balls.
Right on, Daniel. Well, you having a good Labor Day weekend? Are you grilling?
Oh, yeah, I'm going to grill some bratwurst tomorrow. I'm all planning out.
Sweet, yeah, I think I'm going to do some pork chops and some chicken today.
Oh, you lucky bastard.
Yeah, I'm grilling everything. I got some hamburgers, some chicken, some pork chops.
Pork chops and applesauce. But, Brady
Bunch there.
Yeah, Brady Bunch.
All right, well, I'll let you go, Danny. You have a good day, sir.
All right, I'll talk to you later, buddy. Bye.
All right, peace.
That was Todd the Bod, or Todd the God, depending on your perspective. Thank you so much to everybody out there for following the show and participating. Remember to subscribe on all the services. Tune in radio, just search for EODR, as well as Facebook. That's facebook.com/TheRealEndOfDaysRadio. If you want to like that page, I very much appreciate it. It helps quite a bit. Follow me on Twitter. That's @NinjaShoes. And, you know, all the different podcasting services. YouTube, End of Days Radio on YouTube. You can get the show that way if you prefer. There's so many ways to get the show. Really, End of Days Radio is everywhere. It's on everything. All you got to do is Google it, and you will find it. And besides that, I did want to say that... actually, let's save the rest of this for next show. I did want to kind of talk about nerdy things. Like, I've talked about this before, but a lot of people are embarrassed to like certain things, like comic books, or maybe you collect some type of toy, like you collect WWE action figures, or you're a grown woman and you collect Barbie dolls, or you like to collect condoms full of semen in your freezer. I've heard of that one before. God, yeah, there is this, but we'll talk about that next time. I wanted to kind of talk about people's nerdy sort of collections and habits and stuff like that. And for now, I just want to thank all of you guys for joining me. It's a morning show, so I don't want to go too long. It's kind of at an unconventional time. Instead of going deep into the night, we have to kind of fly into the morning, however you want to put it. And I am kind of changing the theme, not changing, but adding a little bit more to the theme of the show. Somebody wrote me an interesting email about how they really like the idea of this show taking place on a pirate ship. And I kind of like that. I kind of like that whole, I don't want to make it too hokey. I'm not going to sit here and go, "Arr, mateys, welcome to End of Days Radio." You know, I'm not going to do anything like that, but I kind of like that theme. So I might incorporate talk about the pirate ship that I'm on, the Black Ship. That's the name of it. It's not the Black Pearl. That would be copyright infringement, but it's the Black Ship. And it's not just a normal pirate ship. It's actually a spaceship that looks like a pirate ship. Yeah, that's right. And we're going out there into the unknown. We're exploring. We're pushing the boundaries of human imagination, and we're going ever further into the darkness and into the void. So this is Daniel aboard the Black Ship, and I am wishing you all farewell until next time. The show will be going on a short hiatus. I do have some very, very important work that I need to finish, but it's not going to be too long of a break. I promise to be back very soon. We just did a lot of shows, so if you haven't gone through all the shows that I just did over the past month, there's a lot of them, please go back and make sure you listen to all of those, and I will be back very soon, within a couple weeks. But until then, this is the End of Days. I'm Daniel. You have a good day, sir.
Winter's coming.
The king has returned from the broken ruins of Babylon. This is the end.